Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassam. First, just want to say welcome to everybody this evening. I guess it's our first Saturday night talk since the end of the retreat time. Special welcome to Mr. and Mrs. Titipaño. Nice to see you again. I think as most of you know, Ajahn Nyatako and I just returned from Sri Lanka after being there for a bit over two months and a week or two, and we just arrived a few days ago. So I think both of our internal clocks are a bit skewed and off, so I'm not sure. I think I'm about 50% here, maybe, by now, and maybe even half of that is only because of some strong Sri Lankan tea a few hours ago. So we'll see what comes out here. I spent a bit of the tea time this afternoon talking about some of the just the various aspects of the journey and the couple of months and the encounters we had with the people and the places on our tour in Sri Lanka. And so I'm not going to go into a general reminiscence of that experience. Kind of covered some of that already. Other than the fact that, for those of you who aren't here at tea time, it was just overall a very uplifting experience to be in a country where there's such a history of Buddhism for a couple of thousand years longer. Not quite as ancient as India, but pretty close, and certainly the stronghold of the Theravada tradition over more than two millennia. And to see an active, thriving Buddhist country with that depth of history, and the way that it's just conditioned the people to be so gentle, kind, generous, open-hearted, and freely giving. It was very moving and inspiring and refreshing to see that as it pervades an entire culture, an entire country. So those kinds of experiences, you know, really uplift my heart, as well as just the immense appreciation for the history, the historical holy sites that we visited in Anuradhapura, Mahendralapura, and Polonnaruwa, as well as all the other places that have special significance, to see how well preserved, developed, and revered they are by the people there. Not just tourist spots, but actually used in a very spiritual way by the people of the country as a way of developing faith in their own practice. So all of that was part and parcel of this trip, and just come back with a lot of good memories of that as well. I thought I'd just maybe focus on sort of one area of the experience there and kind of some of the internal effects it had in my experience and in some ways informed a large amount of the way I tried to practice in the periods of time there that I had for a little bit more quiet meditation in between the excursion parts of the trip. And that time that I'm thinking about is fairly close to the beginning of our trip. After we had arrived in Colombo, spent a few days there, gone down to visit an island hermitage in the south for a few days, and then returned to Colombo, and then made our way into the central part of the country, where the highlands, where it's a bit cooler in mountainous areas, because it's of course a tropical country, very very hot in the perimeter, but relatively cooler in the central part, which is where we spent most of our time, not all, but most of our time in the country. And probably in the, must have been around towards the middle or end of the second week of our time in Sri Lanka, we embarked on a 2-week stay in what's called the Lugala forest area, which is a very remote and pristine part of the wilderness in that central area, and a very well-renowned Western monk who has been there for many, many years, basically has created a series of kutis that are quite some distance, you know, in some cases like a day's walk from one to another, but would build a kuti, spend his time there for maybe a few years, and then pick up and move on, build himself another kuti, pick up and move on, and created a whole series of kutis that are then made available for wandering practitioners to use. They're very simple structures, just three-sided mud huts, essentially, with a corrugated metal roof in most cases. So completely open to the environment, except protected from the elements of rain and sun. But in very remote areas, sometimes a half an hour walk from a village, and in the case of our first place that we stayed, actually from the center of the village to that kuti was about an hour and a half walk, a bit closer to the dhammasala where we would walk daily for alms, maybe about a 50-minute walk to the place where the villagers would greet us to offer food for the daily meal. But pretty far out there, really. And that place we stayed for 9 days and then moved on to another one of them and stayed for about 4 days. So we had a chance in that 2 weeks to stay in two different places and practice in a very, very simple, basic kind of environment. Collecting wood to bake, you know, make our own fires to heat the water for tea, essentially, you know, no electricity. So really out there in the, for me anyway, you know, very basic experience. Ajahn Mataco is more used to these kinds of simple environments, so it was not so strange to him, but it was a bit of a learning curve for me, well supported by his practice in that area. But during that stay in that first kuti, that 9 days, probably about, I don't know, 5 or 6 days into the stay, Ajahn Mataco realized that he needed to go back into Kandy to pick up some supplies that he needed to have, and was, and it's not an easy trip to just walk into the village, catch the bus, go to Kandy, and come back to the village and walk back to the kuti. It's not something that can be done in a day. So the plan was to go over one night, leave after dawn in the morning, and aim to be back the following evening, spending the night in Kandy, coming back the next day. So that was the plan in our minds. And the contingency was is that if something came up, then he would call a mutual friend of ours in the country and another monk and leave a message, and I would make my way into town to find a phone to call that same person to pick up any messages. So that was our sort of escape valve if something didn't seem right. So anyway, the afternoon passed, and I was in that forest area on my own, and actually was enjoying the time. of course, always keeping in the back of my mind that Ajnanatika would, of course, be returning the next day. sort of my reassurance, my mental reassurance. But as fate would have it, that next day came, and by the time the dark of the evening appeared, and Ajnanatika didn't, I realized that this was not likely to be the scenario that was going to be happening. And I, you know, in my own nature, which I'm sure most of you know, I became quite concerned. we all have, you know, until the day that we're enlightened, all of us, every single one of us, has obstructions in our minds. You know, we all have our set of either greeds, hatreds, or delusions, or a combination of all of them lurking in the most bottom recesses of our citta, of our psyche. I have a good dose of probably all of them, but tends towards more of a predominance of anxiety when put in very stressful situations like that. So this particular circumstance was a prime opportunity to tap into that for myself, you know, sort of being inexperienced in the wilderness on my own, being in a foreign country where the language was such that I didn't speak it, being an hour and a half from the nearest village where maybe a couple of people spoke some English, not having any kind of access to communication, phones, it being dark from about 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., you know, 12 hours of sunlight, 12 hours of dark. You know, it brought up a few feelings of the fact, mostly along the lines, not so much of my own concern about safety or what I would do, because I knew that, you know, I would get through the night. I had done gotten through the nights quite successfully the past week or so, and I knew how to get in and get my food and all that kind of stuff, but more along the lines of what happened to him. You know, where is he? Is he okay? Later on, after we got together again, he kind of laughed and pointed out and said, you know, like, gosh, what would it be like if you were a parent? I said, I wouldn't survive. But anyway, I found that a very difficult but challenging time that night, the next day. You know, I basically got through the night and convinced myself, okay, well, probably what happened is that he just got delayed, got back too late. It was too late to walk up, start, not safe to do that. So, you know, have stayed in town and we'll meet at the Dhanasala when I come in for my meal in the morning. That was kind of how I framed it as a way of feeling peaceful. And so the next morning comes and I get up and I get down and make it down to the Dhanasala by about 7:30 in the morning, 50 minutes walk, and he's not there. And so once again got this wave of, oh no, you know, what's happened? But then remembered our contingency plan of going into call. And then it's another, you know, 35 minutes maybe, or a little bit longer, into the village itself to where I was able to find a man at the post office who spoke fairly good English and had a phone that I could use to call, and got reassured by our mutual friend that Ajnanatika had indeed made contact, and he had just not been able, he had, I guess, essentially gotten off at the wrong bus stop or stayed on the bus too long and ended up in a village that was too far away to get back that night and that morning, and would likely be on his way fairly soon. So, of course, appears at the Kuti sometime in the early afternoon, and all is well. But it was an opportunity to really be in a situation where the obstructions that are present in, again, in all of our minds in different ways, in different degrees, in different flavors, come up in challenging circumstances. And if you don't have your usual set of distractions, like talking to somebody, getting another perspective, you know, being able to find some way to distract oneself from what the mind can bring up, then all we're left with is the skills that we've learned to hold these particular mind states as they naturally arise due to past conditions. So this is true for any one of us. Again, you know, this is, you know, not a unique experience, because we've all got various levels of attraction, aversion, confusion at the base of our being, and this is what we have to work with, and these circumstances bring them to clear light. So, you know, as time went on, we moved on and, you know, came and went and did our various things. I tended to stay and use that period after that couple of weeks to settle in one of the places that we were staying in the forest outside of Kandy. And I decided to stay put for a while and do some meditation practice, and Ajahn Yantako went off on a couple of week wandering excursion to Dong. And during the time I was in that practice period of just having lots of open space for personal formal practice, I decided to really explore the various aspects of what had come up during that experience in the Lagala forest, and see if there was ways to develop some more skills in coping with those kinds of states. And used, actually, as a large support, just some readings from Ajahn Chah, as people, I think, were engaged in here during the winter retreat, various readings of the Thai forest masters, including Ajahn Chah. And really appreciated some of the insights that the teachings helped develop and bring forth, and ways of understanding the practice and these mind states that can occur. One of the readings that I was doing was a question and answer session that was written down, and one of the questioners was asking Ajahn Chah, you know, he was saying, oh, I have really lots of aversion, lots of aversive states of mind, and I'm really having trouble coping with them. You know, what's your advice? And after some back and forth questioning, Ajahn Chah's suggestion to this particular monk was, well, you should practice a lot of walking meditation. You know, there's a lot of energy there. Sitting practice isn't a very fruitful thing for you to do right now. You know, really put your mind into your body into walking meditation. And I think part of the question was probably something like, well, how long should I walk before I start sitting again? And the reply that Ajahn Chah gave was something that I had forgotten or hadn't read, or maybe probably read and forgotten, but was a very useful tool for contemplation for me for the rest of that time and continues into now. And it's, he said, basically just said, you know, don't worry about getting rid of mind states, you know, eliminating the thoughts. Don't worry about the fact that, you know, you're having these unskillful states of mind. Just keep walking until the mind separates from the thoughts. And it was very clear. It's not keep walking until the mind gets peaceful, until the thoughts subside, until the moods or emotions go away. It was keep walking until the mind or the awareness separates from the thoughts, so that there is still the presence of that possibly skillful, unpleasant, certainly unpleasant mood, or the unpleasant series of thoughts, but the mind, the awareness, isn't entangled with them. It's like Ajahn Chah's often quoted simile of still flowing water. The mind is like still flowing water. There's the stillness, and then there's the activity. And the two are in the same space, so to speak. But if they're not mingled and merged and confused with each other, then there is more clarity. There is clarity. There is separation. And that's where the development of peace can occur. Not through the elimination, eradication, annihilation of unpleasant states of mind, unpleasant states of body, physical feeling, mental feeling, that are the results of vipaka, the results of past karma. We don't have a huge amount of control. We have only moderate amounts of control as to our experiences that come to us from the past conditions. But we have the opportunity to relate to them in a different way. So in some of these strong states, you know, his advice in this particular case, again, walking meditation, just keep walking until the mind separates from the thoughts or the moods. Then, if it seems appropriate, go to the sitting practice. So I use that as a theme for those few weeks to inform my situation, and would just really basically do a lot of walking meditation until I got that sense of, not forcefully in any way whatsoever, but the mind just kind of stepping back and being able to have some distance, some perspective on the object in the mind, whatever it was, and not to be enmeshed with it, proliferating about it, developing vast channels of papancha, proliferation around it, but just accepting it as it appears and disappears. And then with that perspective, being able to settle down and let the mind be not so entangled with the objects of mind. And noticing that in that kind of practice, if we engage in it, then there still is this movement of mind at times. It's not like you've just moved into a jhana state or intense samadhi or intense relinquishment or realization by any means, although I guess that's possible at that point. But there still can be a motion in the mind and an urge to join with something, an urge to engage with something, the urge to merge. And what's useful and important at that time is to not allow yourself to merge back with that that unskillful state of mind or that unskillful thinking process, but to then really pick up a skillful object to merge with, such as the body, the breathing, some other focus for as an object of meditation that's peaceful, calm-inducing. So it's using reflection sometimes to establish that state of mind that allows one to separate from the negative experience enough to then be able to focus and settle on a more skillful object to continue the cycle of developing calm and insight back and forth. And I think there's other ways, in fact, I'm sure there are other ways of developing that, reinforcing that ability of the mind to separate from the thought or the mood, the object that's unskillful. Not only through something like walking meditation, which is a very tangible, good way to do it, but also through other contemplations that allow a spaciousness to come to come forth that allows that kind of separation, disentanglement to happen. Of course, you know, one of the ways is by developing brahma-viharas, very expanded spacious states of mind. One of the monks that was in and out of the monasteries that we were staying in, particularly one in Kandy, was an Austrian monk named Sangamaji. And his father had recently passed away, and he had made up a little placard, which some of you have seen, that was sort of a desk placard with a few sayings, the five subjects for frequent recollection, and also just a short metaphrasing. And that metaphrasing that he had on there, I thought, was a very nice, simple interpretation, very similar to one that many people have done, but with just some very straightforward phrasing. I can't remember the whole thing, but essentially starting with something like, may you be well and happy. You know, may you have a life with ease. And then the third line was one that I hadn't really seen before that has struck me as just a very lovely reflection as we're going through the various people, starting with ourselves and moving to people that we feel close to or feel favorably towards, and all the way through those who we have difficulty with, strangers, etc. That third line is, I accept you as you are and offer you my friendship. And then the last is, may you realize ultimate peace, or something like that. May you be full of peace. But that third line of I accept you as you are and offer you my friendship was a sort of an adaptation from a verse in the Theragata. And I just found that a very heart-opening kind of reflection, and used that as a way of settling, opening, expanding the mind in reference to all various sorts of people in my life. So that's another kind of way of establishing that space of mind that allows the separation, separation between awareness and object, thoughts, moods to occur. Another one that I perennially find useful in establishing that sense of ease and distance, separation, mindfulness, is just through the first reflection from the Anattalakkhana Sutta. And just repeating it and in kind of internalizing it in a moment of difficult experience or confusing mind state or unpleasant mind state or unpleasant states of physicality, body dukkha as well as mind dukkha. Just that reflection of the body is not self. If the body or the mind, the feelings, the perceptions, if they were self, then they would not lead to reflection, and one could be in charge of them. One would have control over them and say, let them be like this rather than be like this. But since all of these factors of body and mind are not self, therefore, by their very nature, by the very nature of their existence in samsara as part of the conditioned realm, they therefore must lead to affliction. And one cannot say in regard to them, let them be different, let them be the way I want them to be. And just bringing that level of acceptance into a unpleasant, difficult, hard-to-bear state of body or mind, realizing that, yeah, we have some control, we have some ability to affect, and we need to use those tools that we can use, whether it's medicines or, you know, friendship or whatever. But essentially, we are experiencing the results of past action. Vipaka is coming. Resultant conditions are appearing based on karma. And, you know, on an ultimate sense, we just don't have control, ultimate control over that. The best we can do is develop skillful ways to respond We can't expect them to cease, to stop, to be other than what they are as they arise through their own natural conditions. And taking that and really hammering it in with the goal of depersonalizing our unpleasant experiences. None of us can escape that conditioning. None of us can avoid the results of that, for better or for worse. That's what our inheritance is. And because there is no ultimate self in charge, there is no way to ultimately control that experience. So that reflection depersonalizes it. It doesn't excuse one from the responsibility of having to deal with it, but it takes it out of the realm of, this is me, this is my problem, this is my fault, this is a highly intense personal failure. These are the results of past causes and conditions coming to fruition, and my responsibility is having the ability to respond. That's what responsibility is, having the ability to respond in a skillful way. And that is through then allowing the mind to separate from the object and giving it its due attention without moving into it and merging with it, and letting it have its natural life and developing the skills of spaciousness, contentment, kindness towards ourselves, our situation, and others. And that kind of approach, I find, helps to develop both the calming aspects of the practice as well as the insight aspects of the practice. And of course, as everybody knows, the ultimate place that that can be taken is through to complete relinquishment. Over who knows how many years and lifetimes of steady effort will differ for each one of us. But knowing that there is a path that we can choose to help us move in that direction is something that we can all develop if we put our minds and our hearts into it, with the proper supports of good spiritual friends, people who are helping us along the way, requisites that we have provided for us, and the access to the teachings of the Buddha. So that was just a brief kind of reflection, contemplation on one of the ways that I was able to continue my practice while we were there in Sri Lanka, and I learned a lot about myself there, and as well as having some wonderful experiences, seeing the people, the times, the traditions, the history, and as well as spending that time with a good spiritual friend in Ajinyantako. It was all good stuff in the long run. So I'll just leave it there and offer that for contemplation this evening.
Sadhu, sadhu.